This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm Nick Gillespie. Today we have a special treat for you. We spent 90 minutes talking with readers of Reason and supporters of Reason via Facebook and YouTube in a live podcast featuring Matt Welch, editor-at-large, Catherine Mangu Ward, the editor-in-chief of Reason's journalism division, Peter Suderman, managing editor of Reason.com, and myself. We cover a lot of ground, and we have a lot of laughs and some serious talk, too, about every topic conceivably of interest to libertarians. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the 2018 Reason Magazine Editorial Juggernaut Webathon Telethon. Is that what we're calling it?
No.
Webathon.
It's just a webathon. No, but this thing.
This is a live podcast.
We're a live podcast. So this is the Reason Editors Roundtable Special Edition. We usually do this on Monday. So go there on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and subscribe to it all. But we're doing it especially on Wednesday of this week in conjunction with the Reason Webathon, our 11th annual attempt and a pleasurable week of asking you, our favorite people in the universe, to give us your tax-deductible donations to make all of our journalism and commentary possible out there. We want to welcome everybody out there, whether you're watching on YouTube or Facebook or at Reason itself, whether you're libertarian or not, whether you're struggling with your faith, please enjoy us. And all throughout this live video cast streaming thing that we're doing, send us questions. The mechanisms by which you can send those questions are at an email address that I don't have in front of me, and also by comments on the blog post that we have at reason.com right now and on our Twitter feed and on etc. I am joined, as we always are or usually are, on the Reason Editor podcast by Catherine Mangu Ward, editor-in-chief of Everything Reason.
Hi.
Nick Gillespie, some guy we found on the street, and Peter Suderman.
What was that?
Cheers, guys.
Managing editor of Reason.com. That's not true. Nick has been off the street and high on Reason for more than 25 years.
That is correct. That's 25 plus. I started in October of 93.
So it's you and Bob Poole at this point are kind of the longest tenured Reason
You know,
people.
There's also Jacob Sellum has a discontinuous record that's longer because he was here first but then left and then came back.
He ascended briefly to a higher plane of consciousness and then rejoined us here on the
Was he using alliterative headlines even in 1992?
He's the worst headline writer in history.
Yeah.
Okay. No, not true. He just wrote really high quality 90s headlines. Headlines are just different
now. They're just bad.
Why puns? The past tense?
Yeah.
He doesn't write headlines anymore.
So, and then also Barb Birch, actually, our former art director, who now is helps out with certain elements, also predates me by at least a couple of months.
That's amazing.
What so, we're saying is we've all been around forever and you should pay our salaries.
Not exactly that, but we're going to get to that in a second. Yes. You could contribute to the payment of our salaries and our booze habits. So to go and give to us, again, tax deductible donations, it could be in cash. It can be in cryptocurrencies. Go to reason.com/webathon. And if you're writing about any of this right now on a social media platform, do the little hashtag buddy and then webathon 2018. At around the commencement of this particular broadcast, and this is day two, we've been doing this for a little over 24 hours. Two great posts from Nick and Catherine already on this, although tomorrow's just
God, I knew just, the minute you just, said something nice I, about our webathon I post, know. I was like, he's going to say
it's
his
not,
is better.
It's not about me. It's just about the found material that we have. Not going to spoil it. However, from this time, so we're doing a week-long webathon. We've had about 200 donors, I see here, which is an incredible number. I think, in fact, it's even more than maybe the first webathon that we did 11 years ago. And a total of around $36,000 in donations. Thank you. That's amazing. Let's see about making those numbers legit over the next 60 to 90 minutes or however long we are here.
I think we got to double it otherwise.
You think we double it or else are you going to set yourself up for that kind of a...
Yeah, I'm going full Buddhist monk.
Okay. I mean, I thought the vegan thing was kind
You're going to go quietly meditate?
I'm just going to pour gasoline over my head and light myself on fire.
So you're going to go quietly meditate, please, instead?
We were going to have s'mores this afternoon anyway in the office.
So. That's true.
I wish we had office s'mores.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's against a fire code of some sort.
At any rate, there is a matching donation system that's also still available to us right now. I'm going to read this off of a teleprompter known as my computer, because these are sometimes difficult to describe. One reason donor has agreed to match the first $25,000 in gifts from during this telephone from people who have never given before to Reason over our last 11 years of doing this, and also just in the history of Reason, or who increase their giving. If they increase their giving, another donor will match that increase from last year's total by another $25,000. And I'm pretty sure none of that makes sense the way that I just talked about it, but that's not the fault of the person who wrote this. Let's go to questions, because we have a lot of them, and I'm already tired of hearing myself talk. This is a good way to actually start off. Tony Flaherty from Facebook, and sorry for mispronouncing your last name. And your first name. Why does Reason need to beg for donations, Catherine? A business shouldn't be in business if they don't have a profitable business model. Begging for money isn't a sound business model. Just a thought.
I love the for a magazine called Reason. This is a very reasonable question. It's a strong place for us to start. So two things. First, Reason is published by a nonprofit, has been since 1978. And you may have noticed that lots of other journalistic outlets are just now getting up in that game, because we are totally ahead of every single curve. Is that not true, Matt Walsh?
Pretty much.
So even the begging curve.
Especially the begging curve. First. And journalism that is published by nonprofits has a lot of advantages, and one of them is that we are not beholden to advertisers. We are not beholden to anyone, really, because so many people give us money that we get a lot of freedom and flexibility out of that. So thank you for your donations, and thank you for your question. And not all businesses are justified by their profits, as even Ayn Rand would remind us.
And also, these are parts of our revenue model itself, too. I would add to what Catherine just said, that the number, the total number of donations actually makes us more flexible. There's no single person on this earth who, if they totally changed their mind about Reason tomorrow or keeled over or whatever, any calamity can happen. There's no a single person on which Reason's existence depends, with the exception of possibly Nick's or Bob Pools, to be frank about it. However, that's because we have this diversified portfolio. Opinion journalism, magazines of opinion journalism, they all either have a rich benefactor who, when they get bored with losing money, suddenly change their mind and then the magazine goes per quacky, or they have a nonprofit model, or they just lose money hand over fist. I would just invite people to look at the modern history of the New Republic to see what it's like to not have a stable nonprofit model. Let's go to a question for Peter Suderman from Brent Cordner of Twitter. Says, should libertarians be in favor, and he spelled that with a U.
We got a Brit up in here.
That's Canadian, even worse. Of universal health care when it is not achievable via an unregulated market. Peter.
So I have written in the New York Times, no less, that in fact what we need in America is a party that says that we don't need guaranteed comprehensive coverage by the government. And so if that's what you mean by universal health care, I think my answer is no. If what you mean by universal health care is the maximum number of people with easy, affordable access to health care, I think libertarians can and should be in favor of that. There are different systems that you could design and think of that might get us there. The system we have is not that.
Any additions from our other crowd here? We're good in letting us.
Well, isn't it kind of, is there any reason, Peter, to think that healthcare would be different than food ultimately, that a free market, you know, relatively unregulated or lightly regulated, ends up throwing off enough wealth as well as enough different stuff, where healthcare, as opposed to having health insurance or having a gold-plated health insurance plan, virtually everybody would be taken care of. And certainly not everybody in Canada goes to the doctor when they need to. So.
If your question is there any reason? The answer is yes. And that would basically be Arrow's theorem, named after the economist Kenneth Arrow, who made a quite popular, influential argument that healthcare is fundamentally different from all other market goods. And so this is kind of the big tension in a lot of thinking and arguments about healthcare is that people who sort of think it should be part of the market basically think, well, that it works basically like food, that it works, you know, not too different from food or from housing or from automobiles. And housing and automobiles also have subsidies attached to them. But that the market basically, like, that people can be informed consumers. And Arrow's argument was you cannot be an informed and intelligent consumer about healthcare because of two things. One is you don't know your own condition, and two is the treatments are too complicated. I think that there is I think that it is not an entirely fallacious argument. On the other hand, it goes he and a lot of folks have taken it way too far. And you can have market mechanisms spring up to take care of the information asymmetry. Spring up though in the market, in the extremely regulated, almost entirely government dominated, even where it's theoretically nominally private system that we have right now.
And you can have charity too, right? So like when accidents befall you, when suddenly you go to the doctor and your headache requires four expensive treatments in 36 hours in an ambulance ride over the East River, hypothetically, you're not price shopping, but in a system where, you know, you're a waif, back when stuff wasn't crowded out, you'd have a charity hospital.
So, I mean, you know, the kind of the ideal model that a lot of folks talk about who are more market oriented is that you buy health insurance when you're young, when you get out of college, when you are in college, when you're in high school, even when you become an adult, before you find out what's going to happen to you in the rest of your life,
so
before the insurance company
finds out.
Right. If you're working at a fish restaurant in Florida with a bunch of alligators, and maybe you have to get the alligator rider. I don't know. But so this is how it works roughly.
Alligator rider is another great job that we should consider having, actually.
I mean, in fact, the fish restaurant that I worked at had an alligator wrangler. But let's talk about, let's get
did
back to the healthcare part, right?
Yeah, let's get back, sure, let's get back to healthcare.
The idea is that you buy it when you're well and when the insurance would be cheap, and then you keep that plan through the rest of your life and perhaps even buy a guarantee that is like an add-on. There's some research suggesting that these would be quite inexpensive, that you buy your insurance and then you buy an additional sort of top-up guarantee that says they can't raise your rates. And you do that when you're 22 or 25, and you keep that insurance unless you get a better deal, because people would compete in this market rather than the crazy job-attached health insurance market that we have right now. You keep that insurance for the rest of your life, keep paying that low rate or a rate that rises at some sort of pre-negotiated, reasonable amount. And what this does is it detaches health insurance from employment, it makes it portable, and it means that everybody has a reasonable incentive to pay into the system without, say, a mandate, which we sort of don't have anymore.
Let's move to a question that I want to throw at Nick here from Carlos Diablo, hit and run commenter. It seems to be a standard reason dogma now to feel that borders should be completely open and unchecked. Do you feel that this is a radical notion? And do you feel that this should at all be tempered given the complication for this implemented by the ever-growing social safety net?
You know, one of, I think, the biggest problems that we have in talking about immigration policy is that the use of the term open borders, meaning the idea that there are no borders or there are no checkpoints, there's no vetting of anybody done. I think I know when I write about open borders or invoke it, and I suspect people, the rest of you as well, what it means is that you go to a checkpoint and you present identification, and there's a background check on you to see if you have communicable diseases or a criminal record or fleeing from someplace. If you don't, I think the presumption should be that you're allowed to come to this country, live legally for as long as you want, work, et cetera. That's what open borders means to me. It's not willing away the idea of borders for all sorts of reasons. And also, most people, like, you know, you land at an airport, you're already at a place where you're going to be checked one way or the other. You cross borders on roads that have checkpoints and things like that.
But what to the social safety net aspect of it? So I come in, I pass the anal probe at the border, and now I want to get all the way.
Anal
probe was my drinking game word.
So there you go. No, but it, you know, if there is a tension between immigration, having more immigration and a safety net, I think we should be working to minimize the safety net first and foremost. But then when you look at most analyses that look at the aggregate effects of immigration, whether it's legal or illegal, and illegal immigrants, by the way, are at a 10-year low in the country. It's been declining for a decade now and continues to look like it's going to be sloping downward. But they end up being a net benefit to the economy, both in terms of the amount of taxes they pay in over time versus what they take out, the amount of criminality, the amount of economic growth they bring. So that if we want to talk about economic effects, even people, economists who are hostile to more immigration grant that immigration on net is an economic good. Then there were questions about cultural issues, which are, I think, a different kind of a topic that we could discuss.
Well, I also think, I mean, open borders is the same thing now as saying someone is pro-choice or pro-life, right? It's a shorthand that does a disservice to the subtleties of the debate. So when people say reason is open borders, it's the same thing as saying reason is pro-choice, which is to say, actually, virtually everyone at Reason has their own place where they draw and parse lines. And also, anyway, nobody is genuinely advocating a full-fledged, like, utopian version of open borders anywhere in our current functional political system, right? Like, mm-hmm. The thing you described sounds great to me, but it doesn't matter at all because we are so far from that. We are, like, a million miles from that. We are as long as the caravan marched from that. And while it's, of course, good to keep goals and long-term ideas in mind, like, what's actually on the table right now is, should we dramatically reduce legal immigration, which is what is currently happening,
right,
and also crack down on illegal immigration, explicitly using family ties as a lever?
And employer sanctions.
Or should we, like, maybe at least not go backwards on this question, right? Like, that's where Reason is actually...
It's an odd thing, though, too, because 2 years into Trump's presidency, or a little bit less than that, support for immigration, according to public surveys and whatnot, are at all-time highs. So according to Gallup, 75% of Americans now agree with the statement, immigration is good for the country.
But it's
overall.
Not because they all turn into libertarians. It's because they hate Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, that's probably a big part of it. 65% of self-identified Republicans, 85% of self-identified Democrats. But these are historic highs. And America, going back to the colonial period, had a vexed and ambivalent relationship towards immigration. But I think, most Americans agree that immigration is good. Most people dislike the idea of illegal immigration because of the illegal thing. And the way to fix that is by making it easier to come here legally.
A quick lightning round from Maggie over at Hit and Run. And Suderman, you can't take more than 1 minute to do this. What's everyone drinking?
Suderman gets 2 minutes.
This is easy. I'm drinking a Left Hand, which is a Boulevardier with Mole bitters.
That was pretty quick, Nick.
Left hand, really?
I am drinking Perrier.
Also with his left hand.
Yeah.
I am drinking whatever bourbon was in Reason's booze cabinet. And yes, Reason has a booze cabinet. And yes, there's a lot of turnover.
And I'm drinking whatever white wine was in Reason's booze fridge, which usually is a bit dicey, but it's pretty good.
Yeah. Mm.
Pretty delicious.
It's meeting the Welsh French wife standard.
Yes, it is. Another quick lightning round here, which maybe I'll start with. David Dwenke, and I sounds
definitely
like
definitely mispronounced that.
It sounds like I did, but it is pretty phonetic. I think history will judge me kindly from YouTube.
Not if my last name is any indication.
That's got to be a misspelling.
Do you think David is going to judge you kindly?
That's not. It's really not.
This is like Ralph Benershka type of name. There's a missing vowel in here.
Oh, my God. Do I miss Ralph Benershka? Curious what everyone's born again moment was to libertarianism. The who, what, where, when, and how it happened. And in fact, I won't go first because Nick has a better story. Nick, why don't you go first?
I don't have a particularly good story, but... I started reading Reason in high school. My brother went to college and found it in the college bookstore and started sending it back to me. And so I started reading it and I was like, wow, that makes a lot of sense. Around the same time, I discovered Free to Choose by Milton and Rose Friedman. And I was like, oh, that kind of makes sense. And then it kind of went into a latency period, like a retrovirus. And when I went to grad school in the late 80s at the beginning dawn of the
age. Your
immune
system was sufficiently compromised that it developed into full-blown libertarianism?
Pretty much. No, and it was the trigger, the HIV, was political correctness. It was, in the late 80s was the really – particularly after, and I've been thinking a lot about this, what happened, because the professoriate and the academy is much more left-wing than it used to be. I mean, it's always been kind of liberal or leaning to the left. But I think it was when Mike Dukakis lost to George H.W. Bush, people lost their shit in academies and universities, and they felt like for the first time that they were forever going to be the prisoner of a kind of Reagan America. And that's when they really got super politicized and things really became super ideological. And as a result of that, I started thinking about, okay, well, where am I on this? And that's where the libertarian, like a small L libertarian, classical liberal, 19th century, you know, coming out of the 19th century and earlier belief in kind of partial knowledge, pluralism, toleration. And whatnot. And it melded perfectly with the postmodernism, you know, that I was actually kind of being inundated with in the academy at that point.
I told you people that Nick would have the best answer to this, and I was correct, although I don't want to sell short. Suderman, what's your –
There was no one moment, but there were a couple of first exposures, and the very, very first exposure was –
We need to let the disease metaphor go, you guys.
Why not? The disease model works extremely well.
All right? It was the first time
the
aliens
–
The libertarian aliens landed in my life was when I was working at a Books A Million – In Destin, Florida, and Books A Million had one of their selling points was that they had the best magazine rack of the best, and by best I mean the biggest and sort of biggest selection of magazines of any of the major chain bookstores in the country. And of course, you work at a place like this in the sort of winter, spring season when there's nothing big coming out.
On.
And
in
you just
Florida,
have a lot of time to like.
You didn't have any customers.
I mean, it was,
right?
Florida, it was the beach, the right? Like the beach reads are a thing and you still have bookstores at the beach, but they sell during, you know.
Still have bookstores at the beach?
Last time I checked, I mean, not
which
literally
was when you
on
had
the
this
beach.
Job at
so what was the magazine?
Anyway, so
was
Reason magazine,
recent?
And so right, I particularly noticed the "We Know Where You Live" issue that
2004
that was sent to subscribers, showed with an image of their house on the cover, custom printed for them. And so that was sort of like point one. And then later I was reading, I became sort of more interested in kind of political journalism and opinion journalism. And I read a lot of conservatives basically arguing with libertarians and ended up thinking that the libertarians were right. And also at that time spent a fair amount of time, this was when Wikipedia was relatively new, spent a fair amount of time just like reading through the kind of the chain of stuff that you encounter when you just Wikipedia libertarians. And so all of the kind of relevant thinkers, you know, sort of who have influenced a lot of free market types on the right broadly construed, sort of went through and sort of figured out what they were about and then started actually reading their books. And it was, as I wrote, we all did our origin stories for the 50th issue. There was no moment where I changed. What happened was I realized that fundamentally this was who I was. And it wasn't a moment of like, oh, now I'm a libertarian. I wasn't before. It's, wait, that's what I've always been.
That's a bit like that for me too. Catherine?
Ayn Rand. The end.
It usually did begin and it still
did. I was 15.
Usually begin.
I read a bunch of Ayn Rand. I was raised by nice DC good government liberals who tried to save me for the good cause. And then they made a mistake. My mom gave me a copy of The Fountainhead.
Oh.
Which, yeah. Oh,
wow,
yeah.
A lot of regrets there.
Yeah. So, you know, she, for her, it was a book about architecture. And she thought it was a cool book about art and architecture. And I was like, this is my
Little
new life philosophy.
Know.
And then there was a pretty rough summer there where I was probably not great to live with because
everyone
around
me
was like second-handers who should be treated badly or something. And then,
were you calling your parents moochers and looters?
Like my dog. Like everyone.
I mean, that's just facts.
Although
dogs are
moochers
and looters.
And looters.
Yeah. I mean, that's their whole business model.
Why didn't The Fountainhead create more architects? think it did for a while.
Well, I mean, I do. I actually do think the Fountainhead is partially responsible for the fact that in Hollywood, when they want someone to have a profession that's like cool and artistic, but not like, you know, totally artsy fartsy, so like it's like always
Mr. Brady, Mr. Brady, and
exactly.
the Brady Bunch.
Exactly. So I actually do think that's traceable to Ayn Rand, if I had to guess. But anyway, then I went to college and read some other books and discovered that there was maybe a broader term that I could apply to myself.
I am sort of like more like Peter's story on some level. I was brought up as anti-communism was in the air. My dad worked in the defense industry. My stepfather introduced me to Robert Heinlein, speaking of teenage books back in the day, which I thought was pretty cool because there's a lot of naked ladies and shooting stuff, and still not wrong about any of that. And I think I wrote my high school thesis paper was a mashup of how Robert Heinlein's Stranger to Strangeland influenced and was sometimes used as a blueprint of while predicting the Summer of Love in 1967, which then introduced.
Do you have a copy of that?
I do.
Can
it's called
we
The Martian
it?
And the Hippies.
Can we publish it?
It's not that good, sadly.
It's disappointing.
We did publish a version of that.
No.
Of that thesis, not of your piece, but okay. of the thesis that Heinlein is particularly fascinating because he spoke to, you know, both kind of like Cold War hawks and hippies. In
and he made
measure.
A switch, like he, like, because his early stuff is just shoot 'em up and super.
Yeah, what are they called as juveniles and stuff like Starship Troopers and whatnot, his young adult novels,
Freehold or whatever the hell that was called. And then suddenly it's Time Enough for Love, and
it's always time enough. There's always time enough for love.
I mean,
it's like
after,
Jello. There's
after
always
a certain
room
age,
for Jello.
There's not time for anything else.
Yeah.
I think that was a hate crime.
it's early on in hate crimes, but then I lived in Eastern Europe for 8 years, drank Pseudermin. And then exposed me to seeing what post-communism was like, which was terrible, and came back to this country expecting that we had some kind of truth and reconciliation community commissions where, you know, Bill Kristol on or William F. Buckley on one side and you know, Ralph Nader on the other. Oh, that's a bad example. But would sit around and say, you know what, we shouldn't really have supported the Contras so much. Maybe we were wrong about South Africa. All this would have taken place while I was gone because I didn't know because we didn't have the internet over there. And I came back and America was even more dumb than ever. And they're in the middle of the impeachments, as we called them right then. That's when I came back. And so I looked around for, my God, is there anybody here who is sane talking about politics? And that's when I discovered both Virginia Postrels in person. In her case, she sought me out and to buy me lunch, which is very nice because I didn't have any money. And then also Nick Gillespie's Reason, and thought, oh my God, this makes sense to me. So
when did you come back?
1998, in March. So we were in Cuba. Emmanuel was, my wife was in Cuba covering the Pope's historic visit to Cuba. Oh, yeah. And then the entire world's journalistic corps left 2/3 of the way through that trip because of Monica Lewinsky. And man, the Pope and Castro were just pissed.
Sure.
Just
so what we've got here is Ayn Rand, Robert Heinlein, free speech, and the internet, basically.
Yeah.
All right.
That's also
the TLDR version of how you became a libertarian.
Yeah.
Let's follow up on that from James Adams from YouTube. And just to remind everybody, we're here doing a webathon. As I mentioned at the top, we've got $36,000 $36,000, 200 donors.
$36,000, but each of them only gave us $1.
You need to give us more dollars. No, I'd like to see more numbers. Those of you watching, if you're enjoying this, or even if you're doing it out of a sense of spite, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Please.
Matt loves numbers. It's a thing about it.
People love numbers, Peter.
Well, statistics, right?
Numbers are beautiful. Numbers are poetry.
Are you nine every adjective? Why numbers are great.
You're not going to do like a Roger Angel box score thing.
This is a good segue to the next question.
He's all highfalutin.
It's got a number in it.
Does it? Which one? I was going to a different question. You made me now look at process. This is not where I was going to go with, but since she's the boss, Dean Love from Twitter. Yeah, that's your name. What does America feel like when our debt's carrying cost hit $1 trillion? For you, Catherine.
It feels bad. It makes me feel uncomfortable. I don't feel great about it.
By carrying cost, he's talking about interest there, right?
Yeah. This is the money that it costs us to owe all the money we owe, which is coming.
Not a trillion.
But it will be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's coming, right? Yeah, yeah. Like these numbers, accelerate so fast that sometimes these days I make, you know, so every journalist fears making the million billion mistake right. where you just mistype and it's like accidentally an order of magnitude off. But I now am making like the million trillion mistake sometimes. Mm. Like that's where we are in numbers about the government and how much freaking money it owes.
Yeah.
It's bad news. It feels
bad. I mean, the carrying cost alone is, I believe, either already or very, very nearly more than we are paying annually for Medicaid, which is one of the largest programs of social insurance programs of any kind in the country.
And the person who actually, I would say, so far has the best explanation of this is my gal novelist Lionel Shriver, who has written a novel about the life in Brooklyn when this particular apocalypse happens.
That's interesting. We have a lightning round having to do with hair. What's wrong with you people? What's right with you people? We'll start obviously with Nick here from Nikki Palazza. That's a shocker on YouTube. Nick, what is your secret for luscious hair?
Genetics.
Yeah, I think pretty much that's it. It's the only inheritance I got along with a Tupperware mixing bowl that we I don't know. Did you guys grow up with vomit bowls? Like when you were sick, your parents would say,
we called ours a toilet.
Yeah. Right. You can't take that to bed, you know, like sometimes.
But you can sleep
so
in the
bathroom. Go out to the water closet.
It's the hair and the Tupperware vomit bowl.
This is from Delta 900 from YouTube. Tell Suderman the beard looks awesome. Did he join a shave club?
I did not join a shave club. I did try one of those like dollar razor situations a couple of years ago from the internet, and it was not good. The razors, like they were very slippery in your hand, and I was like, "That I'm gonna kill myself."
Was it more of
I got to my late 30s, and like I crossed the Rubicon past 35, and I was like, it needs to be different. The whole things need to be different.
What do you mean? Wait, are you talking about razor quality?
I mean, it was getting different, but maybe not in the way that I wanted it.
Also, it was a pocket square situation happened around the same time, would you say? Yeah.
And he finally weaned himself off microwave pizzas right around the same time.
Well, you know, there's still some relapses. In the way that like President Obama quit smoking.
Yeah.
So not.
Catherine from this is Brianna Enoch, and sorry for mispronouncing your name, from YouTube. Catherine's hair is amazing. Is a simple sentence. It's not a question.
Truth.
Not wrong.
Not genetics.
Not wrong. And anyone who criticizes
although
purple
thanks
hair
to
on the
CRISPR,
internet,
right?
Maybe.
Like you could you do that?
You're asking is my hair currently produced
but
by
like,
CRISPR technology?
We could have genetically engineered purple haired babies.
There are now
in our lifetime.
There is just there were just now we have in theory a pair of twins in China, Lulu and Nana, who are CRISPR babies, and I personally am looking forward to as Ron Bailey says, having more kids when I'm older, who I will like create using CRISPR, and they will have purple hair.
You just freaked me out. The question to me from FN Bob from Twitter, who cut Matt Welch's hair? That's an important question. You don't want to go? It's a place called the Blue and Black, I believe. Not Black, Blue and Black on Court Street in Brooklyn. And I recommend it not necessarily because of the cut, but because they serve you beer. And they play really good like punk rock music.
Didn't you used to go to a place here that had like it was like some kind of asylee ran it or something like that? Diego's around the corner.
Oh, Diego's down the street. That's a Washington institution.
Oh, sorry. Hello. It's a Washington institution.
That's called like Diego. What's his face Plaza down there? I mean, that's they have that.
What's his face Plaza?
Yeah, I mean, it's called that
it's
little
the street is
named
after
him.
The
and
barber.
They've got 8x10s of every Supreme Court anti-justice in history. It's all phenomenal. Mm. Let's try to bait Nick Moore on immigration here. Gotfish. YouTube for Nick. Nick, you had done a video on immigration and specifically border control. Concerning what happened over the Thanksgiving weekend, have your thoughts changed about immigration and border security?
No. To me, the weirdest thing about the discourse about immigration is like, so you have a couple hundred people who are storming the border. And, you know, it's true that there have been, in every year going back 10 years, there have been hundreds of kind of instances where border control actually does use pepper spray or like has to restrain people from crossing the border. But I mean, for God's sake, like if we can't handle a couple of hundred, you know, migrants trying to flood the zone, what do we got going on? I think, again, you know, the larger question is, like, do we want to process people in a way that is fair and equitable and makes sense? And, you know, we should be doing more of that. But I don't see the whole caravan stuff is a great example, I think, of where Donald Trump has been really good at kind of stoking anxiety about. I mean, it really is just kind of this cloud of dust. It's almost like the people who are chasing after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. They're always way off in the horizon, and they're always kicking up, you know, like, my God, you know, they're coming closer. And it's like, by the time they get here, it'll be a couple of hundred people down from a few thousand. We have, what, 330 million people in the country. I think we can handle this.
Reason.com/webathon. Go there, please donate. And on social medias, hashtag webathon2018, in case you are flinging rhetorical feces at us. Here is a question from Twitter. To Matt Welch. What low-hanging fruit/policy improvements do you all think are reasonable to expect to be implemented in the next 5 to 10 years? Reasonable to expect is loaded, but I would imagine the next 5 to 10 years we're going to see, even the next 5 to 10 days maybe, if things go in the right direction. We're going to see a continuation of what we've seen since Colorado and Washington in 2012, which is the dismantling of all the various pieces of the drug war. In fact, this morning, in its own way, there was a dismantling of a little piece of the drug war in the Supreme Court oral arguments, right? An argument about civil asset forfeiture, which what does that have to do with drugs? It has everything to do with drugs, like a lot of terrible things. Like when the Supreme Court started looking at and excusing these kinds of civil asset forfeiture is when the cops say this computer was involved in a drug transaction. I'm going to take it, even though I'm not charging Catherine with a crime. And then I'm going to take it and I'm going to auction it off or just steal it. Why are you turning away from me? I want to look.
No.
And I'm going to keep the money to fund my operations. It's like crazy. They're stealing from you. There's no other way around that. But in the beginning, in the early 1970s.
And often you don't even have to be convicted.
You don't have to be charged.
It's just because they think they sort of tag you as being involved in something.
Go back and look at the argumentation for doing that in the early 1970s. It was about two things. It was about the mafia. And it was about drugs. And it was also about the drug mafia. In the Supreme Court cases themselves, I believe it was William Rehnquist wrote the majority opinion in the relevant case, which I can't cite off the top of my head, in which he basically said, yeah, I know this looks really kind of crazy. What with the whole Fourth Amendment and anything? But, you know, troubled times called for troubled solutions. It's terrible. So it's all...
I feel super confident that Rehnquist did not.
That's direct. That's a cite.
Right. That sentence.
I look in the Vault Conspiracy. It's I'm just block quoting myself here. But no, it was all about drugs. And so we're going to see lots of little things like this. Today, just in case no one knows what I'm talking about, there was a civil asset forfeiture case involving the state of Indiana doing some terrible thing. And Neil Gorsuch said to the Solicitor General, I believe, of Indiana, again, this is a paraphrase.
Direct quote.
Like, bro, are you even kidding me? What are you talking about? What are you thinking about?
That seems more like a Kavanaugh line.
Too soon.
God, so good. So yes, we're going to see a lot more of this. We're going to see more states legalize. We finally got illegal marijuana on the shop on the East Coast. I never thought I'd see that happen. Terrible coast on the East. And there's so much of in Florida, of all places, on Election Day, they re-enfranchised ex-felons who for decades have not been allowed to vote. These are all tiny little bits of the drug war. Next 5 to 10 years, I think that's going to be the biggest thing. But are there other things in the next 5 to 10 years that you would either expect or think that if we sort of push, maybe the wall will come?
This is a small one, but I think it's significant and ties into something we were talking about before. I think over-the-counter birth control is coming. I think that's, literally December 1968, like one of the very, very first issues of Reason cover story is about birth control. So I recognize that it's a little crazy to be like, we're going to solve this now, guys. But some other stuff came true from those issues, so you never know. And I think that the combination of a Republican in power who is encroaching on Obamacare's mandate to provide birth control. It was allowing more and more exemptions to that, which I think is a good thing. And the realization that Plan B, the emergency contraception being over the counter, has not in fact resulted in like just like women's bodies scattered all over the ground with their like ovaries dangling out. It's going to be fine. Everyone's recognizing it's going to be fine. And even though we are generally not moving in the direction of giving people more control over their bodies and their own health information, I do think birth control could be liberated in some forms from the pharmacist. That's
Suderman, what, 5, 10
years? I mean, what's could reasonably expect? Could reasonably expect could mean, it could mean like this is totally reasonable and we should expect it. And then there's—
Is it reasonable
like,
to expect
likely
it?
To yeah. happen. So like I cover mostly federal policy. The federal level, like nothing is actually, nothing good is actually likely.
That's so sad.
However, it is completely
net neutrality,
reasonable.
Dude. You wrote about net neutrality 6 years ago and it was repealed.
Okay,
is that a
so
good thing?
I'm thinking of Congress here, but at the federal level, it is completely reasonable to expect Congress to return to normal order when it comes to the budgeting process. They should do it. They have been out of, they have not been doing it for basically 20 years now. It has been breaking down since, I want to say, the last time they passed all of the appropriations bills correctly, according to Hoyle, like by September, and had the whole shebang put together was like right before you came back to the United States. I believe it was 97.
And then there was a complete break. I mean, a near complete breakdown under Obama.
Yeah. I mean, it got worse under George Bush, and it was much worse than it totally broke down under Obama. And there's not really any sign that it's going to come back. You have a couple of senators who sort of gripe about it every now and then, but it could and it should. It wouldn't be that hard. And we wouldn't end up in these dumb situations like literally we are in now, in which it looks quite possible. I don't want to say it's likely, but it certainly looks possible that the combination of Democratic anti-Trumpers and Senate GOP muckety mucks and Donald Trump could end up shutting down the government on December 7th because they can't agree to give Trump the $5 billion he wants to build his stupid border wall, which was supposed to be paid for by Mexico anyway.
That was Mexicans.
Nick, what's Mexicans?
School choice. I think universal school choice in the sense that parents or the idea that you should go to schools that you are assigned to is breaking down rapidly. And as in many other parts of our lives where we do have more autonomy and choice, I think the logic of just saying, you know what, let's have schools, public schools, charter schools mostly kind of compete for students and have people sign up. I think that's accelerating. And it, you know, within 5 to 10 years, I think that's low hanging fruit. That'll have a massive change on the way that people get educated, and it'll particularly help the lower income people.
All right. Reason.com, Webathon. Hello. Hi. Go. More questions here. Let's throw this to Catherine as the current brand manager here. Joe Clave from Hit and Run. Do you see it as a victory when Republican pundits and politicians, why I just got to be Republican, dude? Pundits and politicians self-identify as libertarian or libertarian on issue X, or is it a watering down / bastardization of libertarianism?
Yeah, I don't know. I used to always say, like, anybody who wants a label, like, you do it, come on in, like, the tent is huge, let's hang out at the party together. The rise of the alt-right out of the ranks of people who identified many of them as libertarians has made me rethink that somewhat. This question is about sort of mainstream Republican types who identify as libertarian. That I generally like because I think lots of people describe themselves as Republicans and in fact even Reason staffers just because they didn't have another word. And if we can give them another word that's like Republican but better, then yes, they're welcome to it.
All right. Stephen Karen from YouTube. What is the libertarian position on the public notification of sex offenders? What is your personal opinion about the public notification of sex offenders? Peter, you're from Florida.
I mean, we've done a bunch of stories on
that's
this.
Like an opt-out, right? On your birth certificate, you're put on a sex registry.
And I mean, like
Cass Sunstein's next book, I think.
Florida man may have some additional connotations attached to it, and not even when you're naked in a Waffle House, like strangling a chicken at 2 in the morning.
Euphemisms.
So the problem with sex offender registries is that they are often
far too broad in who they cover. They often end up keeping people who in some cases have done something that is really wrong, but keeping people who have done at most in some cases just one thing that was quite wrong and who have otherwise, you know, sort of paid for their crime, end up keeping those people out of a lot of communities and unable in some cases just to live anywhere in cities. And like, and this, I think, this is a hard thing to sell to, say, parents, you know, in nice school districts, in nice suburban communities. But people who have done one thing wrong and who have changed and who are not likely to be – who've shown no signs that they are going to be repeat offenders, those people deserve a chance to live normal lives. And this is just not a popular message. Like, people just don't want to be around them.
Well, and it's also, I mean, the fact is that the recidivism rate of sex offenders as a group is not higher than it is for other criminals.
And that was like the a idea, myth that was perpetuated.
Yeah, that has been for decades, years. For decades. And, you know, the idea of a sex offender registry, that these crimes are so particularly awful. And then a lot of the times they turn out to be cases where it might be a 17-year-old with a 15-year-old in a consensual relationship that dogs people for a long time. I think it's wrong. And it's also, you don't have to have sympathy for sex offenders to recognize the idea when the government or when the state at whatever level starts creating permanent registries that they make public. This is not a good thing, and we are in many ways – I think we're moving out of a phase where people are done with building more prisons and putting more people in jail. We're not done with the idea of surveilling more people and having people walk among us but then subject to all sorts of different laws and things like that. And I think it's worth – you know, I think sex offender registries are wrong for all of the reasons that Peter talked about, plus the fact that there's no indication that they actually protect the public. So, I mean, it's a useless added cost that creates more of a surveillance.
They weren't intended to protect the public. They were entirely a political scare tactic.
Yeah, well, part of it is the idea of, like, when you buy a house, you know, the realtor or the mortgage company will say at some point, like, you know, here's the sex offender registry. Go check out just to make sure. We're not going to do it for you, et cetera. So, I mean, there is – you know, there's the
but
notion
they were built,
behind it,
announced and campaigned on as a sort of way of playing to a certain type of suburban, you know, sort of safe school district voter who you know, and it's very actually somewhat similar to the way that Donald Trump talks about immigrants, right? It's not exactly the same, but there's a related kind of it was a political
very different
scare
kind
tactic.
Of caravan, but yeah.
Yikes. We have a comment here from Jay Wall at Hit and Run saying, I've listened to the podcast for a couple of years. You're doing it as a Hit and Run, Jay Wall? But this is the first time I've seen what you all look like, because the pictures are really hard to find there at reason.com.
I know,
because it's fun. That's why we all like each other. And I am amazed to say that you are largely how I imagined you look. I know you didn't mean that as a compliment, but thank you, because it could have been a lot worse.
We're all on our own brand.
We're all on our own brand day after day. That's just a reminder to everyone. You can subscribe to said podcast and listen with your ear holes. Over there on Apple Podcasts.
And imagine how we look. You can spend that whole podcast.
Just imagineering Suderman as a Disney character in the Hall of Presidents. But also a Spotify, which we're
moving on. Wait, I'm Pirates of the Caribbean. It's a small one. I mean, yeah.
I don't want to.
I'm making my black rum and, you know, dipping my hair in it.
Have you been to the Pirates of the Caribbean ride since they cleaned it up?
Putting Johnny Depp in it?
But the ride at Disney World and Disneyland, they got rid of the pillaging and all of that, didn't they?
I have not been since like 1995, 1993.
That's fine. We're anti-pillaging.
Like okay.
I look forward to the next Robert Bly book about how we're losing an innocence here. We've got a trifecta about climate change. I'm actually going to throw it out in a libertarian sense to the panel here. Three questions. They can each take whatever one they want. Andy Favor says, why the blind support for the climate change narrative? Gareth Cox says, what are some libertarian climate change policies? And Brent Cordner says, how will markets solve global warming? Who wants what piece? Go.
That's so good. That's the whole spectrum of questions, actually. That's kind of great. The answer here and always is Ron Bailey. Ron Bailey is the answer to why are we so credulous of this so-called climate change? Because Ron Bailey reads graphs for fun. He eats statistics for breakfast, and he says it's real. And I, for one, trust Ron Bailey in a way that I trust virtually no one else, certainly not the people at this table. And Ron Bailey also has some excellent answers for questions two and three. He is a supporter of carbon taxes as the least bad thing that might happen, that people might actually go for. It is the least inefficient way to price in some of the negative externalities of human-produced greenhouse gases. Also, though, there's all kinds of cool technology out there that might work to reduce global warming without actually just making everybody sit at home in the dark without even a candle, because that's what environmentalists want us to do.
I'll take a swing at the idea of like how will free markets solve or stop climate change. They won't, but what they will do is they'll make it make us more resilient and able to live with it. The fact is there is climate change. I agree with Catherine, and Ron is my guru on all of this stuff. I don't doubt that there's, you know, climate change, increased temperatures, all of that kind of variability of weather with the possibility of a catastrophic event. But the real thing is not how do you stop civilization and go back to some level that may or may not have any effect on it. It's like how do you live with it? And you do that by getting richer.
And I would also point out that there's this thing called the Kuznets curve, which is originally observed outside the field of environmental science. But it's the notion that as certain societies, or as all societies, actually, that's the point, it's a curve, get richer, they get cleaner in a way that is not widely observed even at the time in the places that they're getting cleaner, because people are kind of hardwired to believe that that everything's getting worse. And in fact, we're decarboning a little bit in this country. I mean, we are down to what, 1990 levels now of greenhouse gas output in this country. People don't want to hear that. And a lot of the people who are most alarmed about climate change are the ones who are least happy to hear that the biggest single reason for that, especially over the last 5 years, is the replacement of coal factories with hydraulic fracturing. And natural gas, because they're against hydraulic fracturing for its own particular reasons. But there was Noah Rothman was on Morning Joe, I think, a couple of days ago, and just got a ton of heat. And I saw on my Twitter feed, because he said basically the same things that I think are true. One is that most recent projections for how things are going to get worse over the next 5 to 10 years have all overshot how things actually have gone, even though we are warmer every single year. That's true. And the other thing that he said was basically what I just said, which is that getting richer helps you mitigate not just the effects, but the problem itself. These are not non-answers. These are actual answers. And when you want to talk about, okay, what are you willing to trade? Are you willing to trade a point of economic growth per year, per century, for what? For your regulation, we start actually talking to people about what the trade-off they're willing to have. That's a real conversation. It's not a fake one, Peter.
In terms of, policy responses, I like Ron Bailey, favor a clean carbon tax. One of the biggest problems with a simple, straightforward kind of not a lot of exceptions built in. This is the big problem with all of the carbon tax proposals, is that they always get larded up with kind of like carve outs and non-standard exceptions instead of just saying
I think everybody should be against the carbon tax. It becomes
a carbon tax. We should tax things that are bad. Not tax other things. And so you can do a swap with the payroll tax that is revenue neutral, so it doesn't grow the size of government. And what it does is it disincentivizes bad behavior and lets you take more money home in your paycheck.
I'm so, whenever I hear you sing this song, I want to sing along, but it's like, the level of not going to happen is so deep there. Like, oh, I know, we'll just be revenue neutral and have totally fair carbon. Like, I'm with you.
I didn't say Congress was going to pass this. Yeah. I said this was what I would favor. And I explicitly mentioned the carve-outs, because the further away you get from a straightforward clean carbon tax, the less effective and worthwhile a policy.
What is that, though? Claire Mullen what to make for dinner.
But is it just, can I ask with the whole idea behind the carbon tax, is that we can quantify the amount of externality that a, you know, cubic ton or whatever of carbon causes. And so we tax it at that rate to discourage it.
You just guess. I mean, you're just making
a guess,
right?
Yeah, I know. But then it's like, why, you know, and so you're trying to reduce the amount of carbon that's being used. But then that money just goes to whatever the government is going to pay.
Well, that's why
this is why it's complete
horseshit. Depends on how these things end up getting structured.
And it's just like, there's another policy that I'm, let innovation go. And
there's another policy that I actually think is pretty interesting, which is basically say, we take no action at all, except we impose a small sort of growth fee on the economy that says that a small percentage of our growth over the next 100 years, we're going to take that money and we're going to put it towards specifically, like, we're going to pay people to try and figure out what to do. And so we say, like, let's let the economy grow as fast as it can, and we will just sort of, and we will just devote a small percentage of the growth to pay
growth,
and like
growth
and so it's a pro growth
windfall profits
basically
tax.
Says yeah, yeah, basically. Yeah, those are good. And I don't, you know, again, you can see that policy going wrong, but it also wouldn't be catastrophic and wouldn't be too expensive.
I can
and is
only
like,
see
sort of
that policy
from, I think, some of the right premises
going wrong. I'm just going to ask this question because we've just demonstrated an answer to it, unless it's been removed since the last time that I was looking here. We know what you all, this is from Chris Card at YouTube. We know what you all at Reason generally agree on. What do you generally disagree on? We
there
disagree
it is.
On carbon yeah. tax.
How to solve global warming.
We disagree, and this was an
statistics,
earlier question
numbers.
That we didn't ask, but taxation is theft. She's yes, Nick is no. What else do we disagree
I
on?
I think there's Peter, some disagreement on, Isaac Asimov versus Robert Heinlein.
That oh, that's true. Should we take a vote?
I mean, so like, I like
Heinlein
both of
them, versus Asimov.
The
like,
only
I have a clear
thing that Asimov has over Heinlein are sideburns.
Let's vote.
He's which terrible on every
Asimov.
Other level.
Heinlein.
It's a generational divide.
Yeah, even though, weren't they basically the same age?
Let's keep going. Brian Brady from email. That 20th century technology says, what's a reduce, not reform government guy to do? The Libertarian Party is so ideologically pure, is it, Brian, that it can't get elected. Well, elected Republicans are increasingly crony capitalists and elected Democrats are becoming Stalinists. I think you might be engaging in some hyperbole, Brian, but you posed some interesting
questions.
We do
not do that here.
We no.
Never.
Never. Yeah. That's not hyperbole itself. I think Justin Amash, pretty much one of the only good members of Congress, had a tweet just today about basically the same thing. Like
it's a legit question though. Like yes. What are you going to do when you want to try and make
and
a little less?
My
government?
Answer to you is go read your Hayek so you can tell me what's in it. But also that there is no one true way, man. I mean, there's you can.
What are you talking about?
No, there is no one true way.
Nick knows the one true way.
No,
and he's
no,
about
I'm
to
not
tell
saying
us.
That. What you, what you got to like, you got to keep on keeping on, and you fight for a reduction in the size, scope, and spending of government. That's
right,
all.
But, right, but he's talking.
That's what
about,
he's saying.
Like, what does he
no,
do with
he's
his
talking
vote?
About. He's talking about his
you
vote.
Vote. You vote for people who say that they're going
to
reduce the size, scope,
move
and spending
to Michigan,
of government.
Vote for Justin Amash.
And drink Founders beer because it's made in Justin Amash's.
I just.
I think the answer here is seasteading. Just want to throw that out there.
That's drink. Get that off. I'm sure there's a crypto question or blockchain question.
Seriously,
lurking
I mean, I
just
do
below.
Think-
but there's so many different ways of political engagement. What we were talking about earlier today about Neil Gorsuch. Okay, there's a small libertarian win. Where did that come from? That came from a 30-40 year process of the libertarian legal movement going from this big to a much bigger to a genuinely competitive element within the broader kind of center right tent out there, as Damon Root has written so wonderfully about, including in his book Overruled. So that's one way that you effect social change that has kind of nothing to do on some level with who won last election, depending on whatever. There's just so many different ways to go about it that I think we tend to way over think or prioritize our approach towards what we should vote for in an election, what party we should root for or whatever. There's other ways to
we
do
think
it.
Of these things as 2 and 4 year cycles because that's when we vote. And that's totally understandable. But real policy change
takes decades. And you can look at good and bad policy changes that have happened basically, certainly in my lifetime. I was born in 1981. And the big policy movements on healthcare, in particular is the one I know, but as you mentioned, sort of the kind of rise of the conservative and libertarian legal movement, the Federalist Society, all of these things are movements and ideas that took decades to develop and to become to come to fruition and to matter. And there were points along all of these along the timeline where all of those kind of looked like failures. Like they might not work, like they were just going to get overtaken by whatever stupid thing was on the front page of the news or CNN that day. But because people stuck with it and sort of believed in the long game. And so this to me, if you want to make real big, you know, a big long-term impact in politics, you have to play a long game and you have to assume that you are going to look like you are failing a lot of the way along the way until you get there.
This is also true of many libertarians. You're going to look like a failure for a while.
Yes.
Every now and then, like, I don't know, it turns out Bitcoin made money or
right?
whatever.
So, yeah, no, but that's the
there's
other
a
thing
future
is,
in
is,
magic after all.
That's the other part of it is that if you're a libertarian, you not only can, but you should believe that a lot of political change comes from unexpected parts places that are not in politics. And you can look at Bitcoin or you can, you know, if Elon Musk, I will say that I am skeptical that this happens, but if Elon Musk sends a bunch of people to Mars, that will not be primarily because somebody in Congress or even because an activist group here, you know, the Send Americans to Mars PAC decided
that's what we should do. Jerome Corsi's next quest yeah. until he got indicted.
Nick, wasn't there a book about how to affect political change outside this
yeah,
country?
I think so.
Let's go lightning round quick here. Catherine, Claire Mullen from Facebook, our friend Claire, asks, what should I make for dinner tonight?
Good, excellent question. My answer for you is kangaroo.
Oh.
An underrated meat, super delicious. They're basically pests, so it's, if anything, a virtue to kill them. Marinate it with something acidic and then serve it with some fig. Delicious.
And Scott, you should start your dinner with a Mezcal Negroni.
Yes. Scott Miller from Facebook asks a pointed question. Peter, tax things that are bad? Who makes that decision?
I mean,
you gotta say, if we're gonna tax anything, which we shouldn't, because taxation is theft.
We have to have a government. And that government.
Do we, though?
So, to go back to what we disagree on, Peter's the libertarian who thinks that maybe we have to have a government. And let's forget that. I'm not even sure I have an opinion about whether we have to have one. We do. And we are going to.
We can agree on that.
And so since we have a government, and since we would rather it not just kind of collapse tomorrow, or at least I would rather it not just sort of collapse into chaos tomorrow. Like, if we're going to shut it down, it should be orderly and planned, which, haha.
Just like we are currently
who
running
creates
the government.
That
and
order.
So, but like, so the government is going to decide this, but we get to elect the government and we get to influence them. And in fact, taxes are one place where voters have a huge amount of influence and have been, and American voters have been quite successful at limiting tax hikes in some ways, not limiting spending increases, but American voters have been quite successful relative to their European Democratic counterparts at limiting tax hikes. And so it's a place where voters have a lot of influence.
Taxes should be recognized first and fully as the revenue necessary to pay for government. They should not be. And this is one of the reasons I'm against a carbon tax is for the same reason I'm against a tobacco tax. And, you know, I realize there are externalities, but it's like, no, taxes should be value free as much as possible. And they should be based on consumption rather than on income or anything else.
Well, a carbon tax does end up taxing consumption to some extent.
No, that's true. It is
and
a
yes,
consumption.
I think all of us? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Catherine is so against taxes that she wouldn't prefer better taxes.
I would prefer better taxes.
But
I mean,
like all of us would agree on the consumption part, which is that we should probably not have, we should either radically lower or not have an income tax at all. And we should be taxing consumption. We should probably do things through a value added tax, which is harder to cheat, is just a pure consumption.
Donate
tax.
To Reason, where we're going to advocate for carbon taxes and the VAT.
I feel like things got off the rails here.
Holy crap.
Give us some more
lightning. Taxes.
Better taxes.
Lower
better.
Taxes.
I think we have the ability to cut his mic.
I want more lightning round questions.
More lightning round questions here. Nick Gillespie, JS Economics from YouTube. Julian Assange, friend or foe of freedom?
I think Julian Assange to date has been very good for freedom. Ooh, I think that
controversial.
I think that WikiLeaks has been a force for good by exposing horrible government actions. And I think it continues to be that. I don't care. I don't know anything about Julian Assange as a person, nor do I care to. I'm thinking that his, you know, little cubbyhole at the Ecuadorian embassy probably smells worse than like any, you know, college senior's dorm room ever could. But WikiLeaks has been great for forced transparency, and more power to him. And just very quickly, you know, the idea that Assange or WikiLeaks is doing Russia's bidding by exposing bad things that the American government or actors in the American government has done, there might be some plausibility or some truth to that. I don't care. Because what I want to know about is what my government is doing and when it's doing bad things. And one other thing is that some of the stuff that WikiLeaks released at various points, it showed diplomatic communications among America where we were actually we were saying the same thing in private and in public in our diplomacy in a way that many other countries weren't. WikiLeaks has been a very, very important and powerful force for good.
Sean Andrew from YouTube asks, new media enables more and more niche celebrities. Can the team comment on this phenomenon? It depends on if I still get scrolled down by our staff here, and their own celebritarian status and the weirdness this begets. I'll answer this instead of the team, but there's the word celebritarian is not a thing. It's not a thing. It's a word that people use. The thing that it describes is not a thing.
That's good enough.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Kyle Lolo from Facebook. Thoughts on the cryptocurrency market's current slide, crypto's long-term impact on our society, and how close the crypto anarchist strain of crypto fits with libertarian ideals. Catherine, why don't you take that since you're the anarchist of the group?
I am optimistic about blockchain, though not super optimistic about cryptocurrency. As currency in the immediate future, it fits wonderfully with all of the anarchism that we got hanging around here. And in fact, is probably the most exciting development in anarchism in my lifetime, as if that's a sentence anyone cares about. Yeah, that's my answer. I think the idea of distributed ledgers is impossible to explain, and Matt Welch still doesn't understand them, but that it will be one of these things like the internet where people don't have to understand it when it just worms its way into their lives and governs everything they do in a way that is less controllable by the state. We will all be better off.
I think the crypto philosophy is great. And there was actually a pretty good New Yorker feature on some of the guys who were involved in this and sort of explaining that they this ran maybe a month or two and kind of laying out a case that for these folks, some of them have become exceptionally well off because of Bitcoin, but they're not really it's not just about the money, and in some cases maybe not even primarily about the money. It's about the idea, which is to create a system where two people who don't know each other, or 1,000 people who don't know each other, can have a transaction between them that they and everyone else involved, everyone else in the world who is involved in the system, can trust, and that you can do it without the government or without any centralized overseer. And that is an incredibly powerful idea that Bitcoin is making happen all the time. And that I think that idea is going – I actually think that idea really will change the world over the next decades.
Can I say also really fast, one great thing about Bitcoin is that since it is totally distributed, there's no one person in charge of it who can screw it up for everyone else by being a douchebag, which I think lots of exciting technological developments have
the douchebag
in charge problem. Maybe even Reason Magazine might have the douchebag in charge problem. But
we don't think of it as a problem.
Charge. It was about me.
We don't think of it as a problem. Yeah, and there's nobody that Congress can call.
Blockchains do not have a douchebag in charge, and they don't have anything that anyone can boycott or call and complain or whatever, and that is sorely needed.
Okay, Rob Schmenz has a question from Facebook. I'll direct this one towards Nicholas Gillespie. I support the legalization of marijuana, he writes, although I do too. I also oppose federal marijuana laws, but I also defended Jeff Sessions when he said he would enforce those federal laws. I do not think it is in our best interest to have elected officials enforcing only those laws they agree with. What is your view of the concept of rule of law? Nick?
Rob Schimmitz, who runs Stossel in the Classroom, he's a friend and an ally in many aspects. I agree you don't want elected officials who only enforce the laws they believe in. By the same token, when drug laws or when laws are bad, they should not be followed. And people should be kicked out of office if enough people agree with them.
You also have to prioritize. The federal government only has so many cops. They don't have enough people to enforce the recreational use of marijuana. They just don't. There's not, you got a body count problem. And so you can ask the federal government to have prioritization issues with it, regardless of rule of law.
But this is also to, Matt, I'll cite one of our shared favorite authors, Bill James, who was talking about whether or not it's legal to block the plate by catchers or other fielders in baseball. You shouldn't, it's also true, you shouldn't have laws that do not actually carry either the popular will or should be laws in the first place. And we should be trying to get rid of
that. That don't reflect reality. Bienru from YouTube. People, just like make it phonetic or invent a new one. How to win a fight with a Bernie Sanders supporter? Do I just walk away?
Just be nice. Be a nice person. You're not going to win on the merits. Nobody wins fights by giving an argument that changes someone's mind in the moment. What you want to do is show that you're a person of goodwill and that you believe they are people of goodwill. And then you want to just like incept whatever idea you think they're the most vulnerable to. And then you just want to be like, change the subject, walk away. I really believe that. I really believe in-person conversation, that is the only way to go. Like, no one has ever browbeaten anyone into submission in a conversation and had them stop being a Bernie Sanders
didn't know
supporter
my parents, but,
and become a libertarian.
I agree. And also, you know, one of the first things is to establish, like, what are you arguing about? Are you arguing about
ends
versus means?
But you should definitely not do that by saying, we need to define some terms.
Yeah, no, quite
because
true.
Because then
true.
You already have
No,
lost.
But I find this is true of a lot of conservatives as well as progressives or whatever, where they're angry about something. But then, like, you know, is it a question of, like, are we trying to help the poor? Are we trying to make the environment cleaner? Are we trying to give more options?
No, I agree with that. I mean, that's my, like,
and then be like, are we arguing about ends or are we arguing about means? And in some cases, like, you get pretty quickly where it's like, no, I don't think people should have these choices, you know, to live this way or to do this or to do that.
And that's when you're like,
money.
How's about those Bill Jameses and the baseballs?
Yeah.
That's good.
Was that good? Did I do
that's
good?
That's very good. Good attempt. Question for Peter, David Burns from YouTube. See that good phonetic name, Dave, even if it's not your name.
This seems,
right?
Frankly, like maybe generationist and also like racist. Dave. You only want white dude names, old white dude names?
Dave doesn't see color.
That's why, I mean, again, it's just my own name.
This
baggage.
pardon. This question may be best suited for Peter because certain people at this table will not understand what language you're speaking. But what are your thoughts on the FTC investigating the use of loot boxes in video games?
My thoughts are that loot boxes are terrible and the FTC shouldn't worry about them at all. The FTC has many, 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 many other things to investigate.
So you don't
and
think
in fact, like fraud is like a legitimate area for the government to be focused on. And prevent, but loot boxes aren't fraud. They advertise that is a system. So basically, video games,
you've triggered him.
Within video games, there are randomized rewards, and it's like a slot machine. And so sometimes, right, in the way that when you sit at a slot machine and drop in your nickels or your quarters or your dollars or whatever, and you pull, and it's just totally randomized based on an algorithm. It's not that you just play until you accidentally win, and that's what video games now do in many cases. But I actually what I would say is that if you look at the last year, there has been a huge player revolt against loot boxes. Players are saying these games suck.
I know exactly.
We don't want to play these games. No. We are not going to buy them. And in several cases, the developers have actually backed down, either removing or limiting how loot boxes affect the play. And so the FTC doesn't need to, because you know what? Gamers themselves figured out how to get game developers to stop making loot boxes that are terrible and ruin your games.
loot box?
This question from Ed Moser from YouTube. I'll take it to Nick because it's fun. This is one of those potential Aleppo question if it works out well. Name five countries you'd withdraw U.S. troops from. Go.
Five countries?
Oh, see, he's already.
No, he's so,
there are that many?
No, but I mean, first off, I would start with Korea. Syria, Iraq, Iran, well, not Iran, but bases in Saudi Arabia, Canada.
U.S. head of Canada.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't know, am I up to five yet?
I think it's pretty close.
Germany,
yeah.
Do we need the medical facilities in Germany to support
Germany and Japan?
Can I get my answer?
All of the wars that we're conducting
the United
in the Middle
States
East.
Border zone.
Nice.
Ooh. There you go.
I'll have you know that when I wrote the weather box at the UC Santa Barbara Daily Nexus newspaper, we would put a little slogan underneath the staff box that would change every day, and it was supposed to be comical. This is a Cold War era joke, Nick. I put it at the bottom as a slogan one day, U.S. out of Nebraska. Yeah. And that's still funny.
You are living the dad joke life right now.
It is.
Yeah. You really are.
It's the only way to do it. Speaking of which, if you haven't rewatched the Libertarian Dad Jokes video from Reason TV from the Bragg brothers and Andrew Heaton.
Matt, do making videos like that, does that cost money?
That costs money. It costs a lot of money for Andrew Heaton to stand in front of a green screen and say really funny things. By which I mean super funny. And that's what we're here. We're doing Webathon here. We started this broadcast a good 75 minutes ago, a very good 75 minutes ago, when we had 200 donors and 36,000.
If we're being honest, so it feels longer.
Yeah. It does. So go to reason.com/webathon. Get in there. There's all kinds of giving levels. You get swag. You get stuff. You get to we have a scroll at the top of the reason.com, the hit and run page that says this gift comes from, Fist of Etiquette. Just throw a name out there.
Just hypothetically.
And then they have a little space to like talk smack too, right?
You can say what name
that you want associated with it. So let's start asking the important questions. This one from Dr. Armageddonit at Twitter. Aside from Matt Welch, do any of you play a musical instrument? And he goes ahead and imagineers this one. I can imagine K. Mangy Ward playing the piccolo. And Peter Sudeman playing the keyboard.
Okay, you know. So I did play the piccolo.
Yes!
So congratulations to you, sir or ma'am.
Did you play with a big band hat on?
Yep. I sure did. I played the flute and the piccolo, and I was the drum major of my high school marching band. So that's everything you need to know about me right there. But Peter's answer to this is even better than mine. Before he answers, I do just want to say, we have discussed here in the office, we could do like a pretty decent, we could field a pretty decent pep band. Like if anybody has any
like
sporting
a
events.
Cantina band.
It'd be like the Star Wars cantina band. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Peter. What did you play?
So I played the sousaphone for seven years. Tuba. Also played a little bit of flute, an awful lot of guitar and bass. And
In what kind of band?
That's several different kinds of bands.
I just want you to say that you're in a ska band.
I was never in a ska band.
I was
never once in a ska band with any instruments.
That sounded like a technicality, the way you said it.
I was never in a ska band, period.
Really?
Of any kind.
I feel like you were.
I knew people in ska bands. I went to their shows. But I was never in a ska band. I played the tuba and the sousaphone.
How are you like, I want to play the sousaphone?
So I can tell you exactly is you go to the Ruckel Middle School band room.
Instrument fair.
Over the summer between fifth and sixth grade when you're about to enter middle school, when the band program is about to start. And you go there during one of the several open house days and they just basically shove a bunch of instruments like up to you.
So you're like the Dalai Lama.
You kind of try them and one of them feels right. Yeah, and you just know
look
it, right?
Look how happy he is.
It's super happy. Thinking about the sousaphone.
Well, no, but the sousaphone is great because the sousaphone dots the I in Script, Ohio. And that State Marching Band.
No, that's of the marchers, that's like of the all, collegiate marching band instruments, that is the most
Of course you will want to play the sousaphone.
It's, I think. I mean, the
Maybe the triangle.
The sousaphones and the drums are sort of the backbone of the marching band. Yeah. I actually did not like marching season. I really much preferred concert season.
I just like that we're not even thinking about Nick Gillespie answering this question.
I have no musical ability.
Yeah. Matt, you should tell us about your...
That's not interesting. James Adams...
Actually, your musical instrument it is a little relevant because you were a busker, right?
Sure. So I played.
And now you're being a busker again.
Opted out of talking about it. So why don't you continue?
Yeah. Right. Continue opting out.
Carry on.
We have a guitar that I could bring you right now.
James Adams from YouTube says, if you had to choose one libertarian book to convince non-libertarians, what would it be? I'll answer first. Man, I'm not about convincing other people. Catherine, you go.
What? That's a terrible answer.
You work for an opinion magazine.
It's weird, isn't it?
I hate to be a broken record, but like I still think it's the Fountainhead.
Really?
Yeah. Like, okay. Well, are we talking about a teenager or a grown ass person? That's because teenager, we're definitely anything in the sort of utopian world breaking science fiction zone is going to be good. Like your Heinleins, your Rands, whatever. For grown-ups, though, I actually would go with my other cliche answer here, which is some Steven Pinker.
I actually will answer the question because if I think about it, this has worked even despite a lack of intention on some levels. But I've recommended to many people Kindly Inquisitors by Jonathan Rauch, the great free speech book from 20 years ago.
But these are not – neither Pinker nor Rauch are hardcore libertarians.
Correct.
Well, right, because you're trying to convince
people who are really not libertarians.
If I'm trying to convince a non-libertarian –
What was the question, though?
The question is if – you had to choose one libertarian book to convince non-libertarians, what would it be?
Okay.
If you had to choose a question to
convince
people
of Independence
about,
I'm thinking,
about the FDA's policies being wrong about approving drugs, what would it be? It would be that Matthew McConaughey book movie, which was not made by a libertarian. Right.
Yep.
Go, Peter, while Nick is
I mean, the moon is a harsh mistress for, you know, anybody under 18 or... possibly even people over 18, depending on what they're like. But if they're going to pick a nonfiction book, probably Capitalism and Freedom, which is in some ways maybe not the greatest book at convincing somebody who's already decided that they are definitely not a libertarian. On the other hand, is one of the greatest elucidations of the ideas and principles of kind of free market and libertarian thinking that's ever been said. And the clarity of that book is really just incredible.
Peter? Not Peter. Nick.
You know what? I'll throw David Bowes's Libertarianism Primer, which was reissued 20 years later as, I think, The Libertarian Mind. I think it's a good kind of overview that is modern and complicated and sophisticated.
We're going to try to go as fast as possible. We have, I think, about 10 minutes more scheduled here or that we're physically able to do here. I will start with the answer to this question from Travis Pelham Boozer on Facebook. What's the over-under on Bill Weld 2020? The over is that he will run for sure, I predict, if there's no other super prominent person who announces that he's interested and whose name rhymes with Flust and Schlamash. And next question here for Catherine Abigail Devereaux from Facebook. What do you folks think of Chinese creepy social credit system that reduces all personal, commercial, political behaviors to a single number? Do you have anything to say about that, Catherine?
I have so many things to say about that, but this is a fast round. So I'm going to just very quickly say, I have read a lot of science fiction that suggests that actually some sort of social karma, social credit score would actually be great, awesome way to live in the future. And I am not ready to abandon that vision. But as always, if you take a good idea and you put it in the hands of an authoritarian regime that values the wrong things, you will get a horrible, distorted outcome that results in the deprivation of civil liberties, which is what we will see in China.
Pretty well done. I'm going to send this one to Nick from David Kadek on Twitter. Will it be more important to support libertarian presidential candidates in 2020 compared to strategic voting to remove Trump from office? And they used a small L in the libertarian case. That's
yeah, I think you should always vote your conscience. I don't really believe in strategic voting in that sense. So all I can say is I'm going to vote for the person who's the most libertarian in 2020, assuming I vote.
Logan Hill from Twitter asks, and I'll direct it to Peter, what are some winning issues for the libertarian movement that could propel them to better success if they focused on it?
National drug legalization. And
don't they do that already?
But a kind of mushy, technocratic, middle-of-the-road, centrist pot legalization along the lines of what Jonathan Rauch suggests wrote about in our 50th issue, where he basically says, you know, the way the pot legalization and gay marriage movements have been won so far is in some ways by talking like a statist, by emphasizing tax revenue and legality and normalcy. Mm-hmm. And I think that to win this issue at the federal level, we're going to have to sort of, like, those of us who maybe don't want to see this as sort of just become like a giant tax scheme are going to have to accept some level of that as like a productive, as being much better than the current regime. And so I think that if the LP sort of lowercase L libertarians dialed back a little bit, just a little every now and then about what they'd sort of the range of outcomes that they might be willing to accept and said, look, let's do this because it is because the country has changed. People now understand like the public is now there. Majority of Republicans, I believe, now favor yes. pot legalization. This is a winning issue. It's low hanging fruit for everyone in any party. We should be doing it at the federal level immediately.
Michael Fiorelli on Twitter asks a question that I'll throw to Catherine. Does the Second Amendment make cops more trigger happy because they can plausibly assume people are armed? That's a good question.
That is a good question. Probably overall, it is fair to say the existence and robustness of the Second Amendment leads to more deaths at the hands of law enforcement. On the other hand, there is, I think, a pretty well-documented pattern of cops using that as a rationalization after the fact and not necessarily good evidence about what they believed in the moment. People say, I thought he had a gun after they shoot someone. That's what they say. We have no idea really what they thought. And one thing that uniform cams and dash cams have shown is that it's very rarely the case that anyone's narrative of the lead up to a shooting is accurate to the reality. So I guess I would just say we shouldn't let cops get away with shooting people because they say the person had a gun. And I am somewhat skeptical that that is always the motivation.
Espada 8 on Hit and Run says, we all need Peter's mug. I presume he means his drink receptacle. Where can we get it?
Unfortunately, that is not for sale. That is a prototype mug. When we relaunch the website, which we hope to do shortly, with the help of your webathon dollars, because making a website ain't free, we will also be relaunching our swag store. And if you are very good little boys and girls, we might let you buy sex, drugs, and robots.
It's mugs. A good mug.
This one is going to be for all of us, I suppose. From Norman T. Hesterton, and we could use this as a possible bounce out here. And thank you all for watching all the way through on YouTube, Facebook, and wherever else you're following us on audio devices as well. What is the best reason to give to Reason today, Peter?
Because we need to have these mugs made, mass produced, and available for all of our readers, listeners, lovers, and haters.
Is it about merchandise for you, Nick?
No, it's not about merch. We're your voice in public debates about politics, culture, and ideas from a principled libertarian perspective. And if you like what we're saying and if you want us to get better and to have better arguments that you can share with your friends, that you can share with your policymakers, et cetera, we need your money. It helps. It's the difference between us doing what we're doing and not doing what we're doing. So if you think libertarianism, if you think Reason style, Reason's vision of the world and of a future of expanding individual liberty and individual autonomy is a good thing, that's what your money is going to fund.
Yeah.
It costs money to do what we do. And, this is something that I think other charities, other things you can give your money to, they often just make an appeal to need. They say, listen, what we're doing is important and it costs money. And I think journalists are a little bit loath to do that. But in this case, we really should, because, you know, this, like, your donations are the difference between can we put Elizabeth Nolan Brown on a plane and fly her out to Arizona to go hang out with the founders of Backpage, who are currently under house arrest or pretty close to it, and talk about their story exclusively with her. Your money is the difference between whether we bring Andrew Heaton in here and put a fur hat on him to do something ridiculous. Your money funds Peter Suderman's very important cocktail journalism. And, you know, your money also funds things that take a long time. Good journalism takes a long time. You put in a FOIA request, and then you lay down to sleep for 100 years. And if you're CJ Cirumella, you do this every single day. Every single day. You put it in. You just go out to the winds, and you say, like, I hope I get a reply. It takes time and resources to do these kinds of things. We are getting information that no one else is getting because we are looking in places that no one else is looking, and you should give us your dollars to do that.
I would add to all of that, which is true and more so. Last year, I think through our entire webathon exercise, we raised $375,000, which is an incredible amount of money. I mean, shattered previous records.
We get like 25, 22-year-olds for that.
You get a lot of 22-year-olds for that. And as importantly, I think it came from more than 1,000 individual donors. And this, many people already subscribe to the magazine, or they don't, or whatever. And it's just 10 bucks here. It's 15, 20 bucks here. You don't understand how resilient that makes us. Think about it for a second. How many magazines out there? It could be a website, but generally speaking, a magazine, a Weekly Standard, a National Review, a Nation, Mother Jones. Would it be totally normal to have the last 20 years worth of editors in chief sitting at a table, not forking each other's eyes out, or, you know, having a huge kind of a split or a chasm between the overall train and the through line of the editorial product. Stop talking about my metaphors. It's not
metaphors.
Right.
Metaphors. God.
It's there's something special about that, and even kind of sacred about that. I can't think of very many magazines that have lasted for this long that. It is identifiable. You can always see that. I mean, there are moments when, you know, Jack Wheeler's going crazy in 1983. Sure, there's enthusiasms and temporal changes here and there, but it's always been from 1968 on, from the premier issue on, it has been coherence, not contradictions, in the words of Lanny Friedlander. And part of that, an integral part of that, is the way that people are attached to it fundamentally. They donate, again, just 10 bucks. They subscribe just a little bit here. But all that creates this sort of mesh that allows it to continue and not be at the whims of a single moment, a single financial crisis, a single whatever. So donate to make that happen and make Catherine be better at what she does and make Catherine Jr. even better than Catherine can ever imagine before.
It's all about Catherine Jr.
That's so troubling.
Who's going to have CRISPR edited purple hair.
By the way, is there a movement to have women be able to have, you know, like Junior, the third, that kind of? Maybe that's something we should be working on. Okay,
Wait, was that a question from YouTube or from Twitter?
That was a hit and run comment
Instagram
situation.
Maybe. That was bad.
When I clone myself, women are waiting for actual cloning to name progeny after ourselves.
Should we close with this? Do we want to do a quick little four-part harmony thing, or do we have any other? It was worth it. 90 minutes was worth it for that look alone. Go to reason.com webathon. All the giving levels are there. It's super easy. Just go click on stuff. Give it all. Thanks for watching. Thanks for all the comments. We couldn't come anywhere close to answering all of these questions, and we love them. It's another thing that we can do that maybe not everybody else gets to do, which is actually interact with the people who make our work possible. So thank you for all of it. Thanks again. And keep on looking out at the reason.com space and hit and run for other fun webathon stuff over the next 4 or 5 days. And for now, we are out of here. Goodbye.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at SoundCloud, at Reason.com, at Spotify, which you can do now. Please keep listening. Thank you.